and tried to pressure Mrs. Fleury into retracting her story and admitting that she and the old lady couldn't have been the people Ruby Elliott saw. Mrs. Fleury wasn't having that, though. The description of them was too good. She was sure they were the right people. So, Talbot went back to Ruby and tried to force her to change her story. You remember that there was another phone box at the opening of Albemarle Way. Talbot tried to persuade Ruby that she'd seen two people struggling in front of that phone box instead. "Which is where things get mildly interesting," said Strike, turning a page in his notebook. According to Ruby's daughter, Ruby was an absent-minded woman, a nervous driver and a poor map reader, with virtually no sense of direction. On the other hand, her daughter claimed she had a very retentive memory for small, visual details. She might not remember what street she'd met an acquaintance on, but she could describe down to the colour of a shoelace what they'd been wearing. She'd been a window dresser in her youth. Given her general vagueness, Talbot should have found it easy to persuade her she'd mistaken the phone box. But the harder he pushed, the firmer she stood. And the reason she stood firm and said the two women couldn't have been in front of the Albemarle phone box was because she'd seen something else happen behind that particular phone box. Something she'd forgotten all about until Talbot mentioned the wedge-shaped building. Don't forget, she didn't know Clerkenwell at all. According to her daughter, Ruby kept driving around in a big circle that night, continually missing Haywood's place where her daughter's new house was. When he said, "Are you sure you didn't see these two struggling women beside the other phone box near the wedge-shaped building on the corner of Albemarle Way?" Ruby suddenly remembered that she'd had to brake at that point in the road because a transit van ahead of her had stopped beside the wedge-shaped building without warning. It was picking up a dark, stocky young woman who was standing in the pouring rain beside the phone box. "The woman? Wait a moment," said Robin, momentarily taking her eyes off the rainy road to glance at Strike. "Dark and stocky. It wasn't Theo." Ruby thought it was. Once she compared her memory of the girl in the rain with the artist's impression of Margot's last patient. Dark-skinned, solid build, thick black hair, plastered to her face because it was so wet, and wearing a pair of... Strike sounded the unfamiliar name out, reading from his notebook. "Coochie earrings." "What are coochie earrings?" "Romany style, according to Ruby's daughter, which might account for Gloria calling Theo gypsyish. Ruby knew clothes and jewellery. It was the kind of detail she noticed. The transit van braked without warning to pick up the girl who could have been Theo, temporarily holding up traffic. Cars behind Ruby were tooting their horns. The dark girl got into the front passenger seat. The transit van moved off in the direction of St. John Street, and Ruby lost sight of it. And she didn't tell Talbot. Her daughter says that by the time she remembered the second incident, she was exhausted by the whole business, sick to death of being ranted at by Talbot and told she must have been mistaken in thinking the two struggling women hadn't been Margot and Creed in drag, and regretting she'd ever come forward in the first place. After Lawson took over the case, she was afraid of what the police and the press would say to her if she suddenly came up with a story of seeing someone who resembled Theo. Rightly or wrongly, she thought it might look as though, having had her first sighting proven to be worthless, she wanted another shot at being important to the inquiry. But her daughter felt okay about telling you all this. Well, Ruby's dead, isn't she? It can't hurt her now. Her daughter made it clear she doesn't think any of this is going to amount to anything, so she might as well tell me the lot. And when all's said and done, said Strike, turning a page in his notebook, we don't know the girl was Theo. Though personally, I think she was. Theo wasn't registered with the practice, so probably wasn't familiar with the area. That corner would make an easily identifiable place to meet the transit van after she'd seen a doctor. Plenty of space for it to pull over. True, said Robin slowly. But if that girl really was Theo, this lets her out of any involvement with Margot's disappearance, doesn't it? She clearly left the surgery alone, got a lift and drove.
Who was driving the van?
I don't know. Anyone? Parent, friend, sibling?
Why didn't Theo come forward after all the police appeals?
Maybe she was scared. Maybe she had a medical problem she didn't want anyone to know about. Plenty of people would rather not get mixed up with the police.
Yeah, you're not wrong, admitted Strike. Well, I still think it's worth knowing that one of the last people to see Margot alive might have left the area in a vehicle big enough to hide a woman in. And speaking of the last person to see Margot alive, Strike added, any response from Gloria Conti?
No, said Robin. If nothing's happened by the end of next week, I'll try and contact her through her husband.
Strike turned a page in his notebook.
After I spoke to Ruby's daughter and the Fleury bloke, I called Dr. Gupta back. Don't know whether you remember, but in my summary of the horoscope notes, I mentioned Scorpio, whose death, according to Talbot, worried Margot.
Yes, said Robin. You speculated Scorpio might be Steve Douthwaite's married friend, who killed herself.
Well remembered, said Strike. Well, Gupta can't remember any patient dying in unexplained circumstances, or in a way that troubled Margot, although he emphasized that all this is 40 years ago, and he can't swear there wasn't such a patient. Then I asked him whether he knew who Joseph Brenner might have been visiting in a block of flats on Skinner Street on the evening Margot disappeared. Gupta says they had a number of patients in Skinner Street, but he can't think of any reason why Brenner would have lied about going on a house call there. Lastly, and not particularly helpfully, Gupta remembers that a couple of men came to pick Gloria up at the end of the practice Christmas party. He remembers one of the men being a lot older, and says he assumed that was Gloria's father. The name Mucky Ricci meant nothing to him.
Midway across Chiswick Bridge, the sun sliced suddenly through a chink in the rain clouds, dazzling their eyes. The dirty Thames beneath the bridge and the shallow puddles flashed laser bright, but seconds later the clouds closed again, and they were driving again through rain, in the dull grey January light, along a straight dual carriageway bordered by shrubs slick with rain and naked trees.
"What about that film?" said Robin, glancing sideways at Strike. "The film that came out of Gregory Talbot's attic. You said you'd tell me in person."
"Ah," said Strike. "Yeah."
He hesitated, looking past the windscreen wipers at the long straight road ahead, glimmering beneath a diagonal curtain of rain.
"It showed a hooded woman being gang-raped and killed."
Robin experienced a slight prickling over her neck and scalp.
"And people get off on that," she muttered in disgust.
He knew from her tone that she hadn't understood, that she thought he was describing a pornographic fiction.
"No," he said, "it wasn't porn. Someone filmed the real thing."
Robin looked around in shock, before turning quickly back to face the road. Her knuckles whitened on the steering wheel. Repulsive images were suddenly forcing their way into her mind. What had Strike seen that made him look so closed up, so blank? Had the hooded woman's body resembled Margot's, the body Una Kennedy had said was all legs?
"You all right?" asked Strike.
"Fine," she almost snapped. "What? What did you see? How?"
But Strike chose to answer a question she hadn't asked.
"The woman had a long scar over the ribcage. There was never any mention of Margot having a scarred ribcage in press reports or police notes. I don't think it was her."
Robin said nothing, but continued to look tense.
"There were four men, involved," Strike continued. "All Caucasian, and all with their faces hidden. There was also a fifth man looking on. His arm came briefly into shot. It could have been Mucky Ricci. There was an out-of-focus big gold ring."
He was trying to reduce the account to a series of dry facts. His leg muscles had tensed up quite as much as Robin's hands, and he was primed to grab the wheel. She'd had a panic attack once before while they were driving.
"What are the police saying?" Robin asked. "Do they know where it came from?"
"Hutchins asked around, An ex-Vice Squad guy thinks it's part of a batch they seized in a raid made on a Soho club in 75. The club was owned by Ricci. They took a load of hardcore pornography out of the basement. One of Talbot's best mates was also Vice Squad. The best guess is that Talbot nicked or copied it after his mate showed it to him.
Why would he do that?
Said Robin, a little desperately. I don't think we're going to get a better answer than because he was mentally ill, said Strike. But the starting point must have been his interest in Ricci. He'd found out that Ricci was registered with a St. John's practice and attended the Christmas party. In the notes, he called Ricci Leo III, said Robin. Yes, I know. Strike's leg muscles relaxed very slightly. This degree of focus and recall on Robin's part didn't suggest somebody about to have a panic attack. "Did you learn my email off by heart?" he asked her. It was Robin's turn to remember Christmas, and the brief solace it had been to bury herself in work at her parents' kitchen table. "I pay attention when I'm reading, that's all."
"Well, I still don't understand why Talbot didn't chase up this Ricci lead, although judging by the horoscope notes, there was a sharp deterioration in his mental state over the 6 months he was in charge of the case. I'm guessing he stole that can of film not long before he got kicked off the force, hence no mention of it in the police notes."
"And then hid it so nobody else could investigate the woman's death," said Robin. Her sympathy for Bill Talbot had just been, if not extinguished, severely dented. Why the hell didn't he take the film back to the police when he was back in his right mind?
I guess because he wanted his job back, and failing that, wanted to make sure he got his pension. Setting aside basic integrity, I can't see that he had a great incentive to admit he tampered with evidence on another case. Everyone was already pissed off at him. Victims' families, press, the force, all blaming him for having fucked up the investigation. And then Lawson, a bloke he doesn't like, takes over and tells him to stay the fuck out of it.
He probably told himself the dead woman was only a prostitute or...
Jesus! Said Robin angrily. I'm not saying only a prostitute, said Strike quickly. I'm guessing at the mindset of a 70s policeman who'd already been publicly shamed for buggering up a high-profile case.
Robin said nothing, but remained stony-faced for the rest of the journey, while Strike, the muscles of his one-and-a-half legs so tense they ached, tried not to make it too obvious that he was keeping a covert eye on the hands, gripping the steering wheel. Chapter 35 Fair Aurora, rising hastily, doth by her blushing tell that she did lie all night in old Tithonus' frozen bed, whereof she seems ashamed inwardly. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen.
Ever been here before?
Strike asked Robin, as she parked in the Hampton Court car park. She'd been silent since he'd told her about the film, and he was trying to break the tension.
No.
They got out of the Land Rover and set off across the car park in the chilly rain.
Where exactly are we meeting, Cynthia?
The Privy Kitchen Café, said Robin. I expect they'll give us a map at the ticket office.
She knew that the film hidden in Gregory Talbot's attic wasn't Strike's fault. He hadn't put it there, hadn't hidden it for 40 years. Couldn't have known, when he inserted it in the projector, that he was about to watch a woman's last, terrified, excruciating moments. She wouldn't have wanted him to withhold the truth about what he'd seen. Nevertheless, his dry and unemotional description had grated on Robin. Reasonably or not, she'd wanted some sign that he had been repulsed, or disgusted, or horrified. But perhaps this was unrealistic. He'd been a military policeman long before Robin had known him, where he'd learned a detachment she sometimes envied. Beneath her determinedly calm exterior, Robin felt shaken and sick, and wanted to know that when Strike had watched the recording of the woman's dying moments, he'd recognized her as a person, as real as he was.
Only a prostitute.
Their footsteps rang out on the wet tarmac as the great red brick palace rose up before them, and Robin, who wanted to drive dreadful images out of her mind, tried to remember everything she knew about Henry VIII, that cruel and corpulent Tudor king
who beheaded two of his six wives, but somehow found herself thinking about Matthew instead. When Robin had been brutally raped by a man in a gorilla mask, who'd been lurking beneath the stairs of her hall of residence, Matthew had been kind, patient, and understanding. Robin's lawyer might be mystified by the source of Matthew's vindictiveness over what should have been a straightforward divorce, but Robin had come to believe that the end of the marriage had been a profound shock to Matthew, because he thought he was owed infinite credit for having helped her through the worst period of her life. Matthew, Robin felt sure, thought she was forever in his debt. Tears prickled in Robin's eyes. Angling her umbrella so that Strike couldn't see her face, she blinked hard until her eyes were clear again. They walked across a cobbled courtyard in silence until Robin came to a sudden halt. Strike, who never enjoyed navigating uneven surfaces with his prosthesis, wasn't sorry to pause, but he was slightly worried that he was about to be on the receiving end of an outburst. "Look at that," Robin said, pointing down at a shining cobblestone. Strike looked closer and saw, to his surprise, a small cross of St. John engraved upon a small square brick.
"Coincidence," he said.
They walked on. Robin looked around, forcing herself to take in her surroundings. They passed into a second courtyard, where a school party in hooded raincoats was being addressed by a guide in a medieval jester's costume.
"Oh, wow,"
said Robin quietly, looking over her shoulder and then walking backwards for a few paces, the better to see the object set high in the wall above the archway.
"Look at that."
Strike did as he was bidden, and saw an enormous, ornate, 16th-century astronomical clock of blue and gold. The signs of the zodiac were marked on the perimeter, both with the glyphs with which Strike had become unwillingly familiar, and with pictures representing each sign. Robin smiled at Strike's expression of mingled surprise and annoyance.
"What?" he said, catching her look of amusement.
"You," she said, turning to walk on, furious at the zodiac.
"If you'd spent 3 weeks wading through all Talbot's bollocks, you wouldn't be keen on the zodiac either," said Strike.
He stood back to allow Robin to enter the palace first. Following the map Strike had been given, they headed along a flagged, covered walkway towards the Privy Kitchen Café.
"Well, I think there's a kind of poetry to astrology," said Robin, who was consciously trying to keep her mind off Talbot's old can of film and her ex-husband.
"I'm not saying it works, but there's a kind of symmetry to it, an order." Through a door to the right, a small Tudor garden came into view. Brightly coloured heraldic beasts stood sentinel over square beds full of 16th-century herbs. The sudden appearance of the spotted leopard, the white hart, and the red dragon seemed to Robin to cheer her on, asserting the potency and allure of symbol and myth.
"It makes a kind of not literal sense," Robin said, as the whimsically strange creatures passed out of sight. "But it survived for a reason."
"Yeah," said Strike. "People'll believe any old shit."
Slightly to his relief, Robin smiled. They entered the white-walled café, which had small leaded windows and dark oak furniture.
"Find us a discreet table, or I'll get the drinks in. What do you want, coffee?"
Choosing a deserted side room, Robin sat down at a table beneath one of the leaded windows and glanced through the potted history of the palace they'd received with their tickets. She learned that the Knights of St. John had once owned the land on which the palace stood, which explained the cross on the cobblestone, and that Cardinal Wolsey had given Henry VIII the palace in a futile bid to stave off his own decline in influence. However, when she read that the ghost of 19-year-old Catherine Howard was supposed to run, screaming along the haunted gallery, eternally begging her 50-year-old husband, the king, not to have her beheaded, Robin closed the pamphlet without reading the rest. Strike arrived with the coffees, to find her with her arms folded, staring into space.
"Everything all right?"
"Yes," she said. "Just thinking about star signs."
"Still," said Strike, with a slight eye roll.
"Jung says it was man's first attempt at psychology. Did you know that?"
"I didn't," said Strike,
sitting down beside her. Robin, as he knew, had been studying psychology at university before she dropped out.
But there's no excuse to keep using it now we've got actual psychology, is there?
Folklore and superstition haven't gone away. They'll never go away. People need them, she said, taking a sip of coffee. I think a purely scientific world would be a cold place. Jung also talked about the collective unconscious, you know, the archetypes lurking in all of us. But Strike, whose mother had ensured that he'd spent a large portion of his childhood in a fog of incense, dirt and mysticism, said shortly,
"Yeah, well, I'm team rational."
"People like feeling connected to something bigger," said Robin, looking up at the rainy sky outside. "I think it makes you feel less lonely. Astrology connects you to the universe, doesn't it? And to ancient myths and ideas."
"And incidentally feeds your ego," said Strike. "Makes you feel less insignificant. Look how special the universe is telling me I am. I don't buy the idea that I've got anything more in common with other people born on November the 23rd than I think being born in Cornwall makes me a person better than someone born in Manchester."
"I never said..."
"You might not, but my oldest mate does," said Strike. "Dave Polworth.
The one who gets ratty when Cornish flags aren't on strawberries.
That's him. Committed Cornish nationalist. He gets defensive about it if you challenge him. I'm not saying we're better than anyone else, but he thinks you shouldn't be able to buy property down there unless you can prove Cornish ethnicity. Don't remind him he was born in Birmingham if you value your teeth."
Robin smiled.
"Same kind of thing, though, isn't it?" said Strike. "I'm special and different because I was born on this bit of rock. I'm special and different because I was born on June the 12th.
"Where you're born does influence who you are, though," said Robin. "Cultural norms and language have an effect, and there have been studies showing people born at different times of the year are more prone to certain health conditions."
"So Roy Phipps bleeds a lot because he was born..." "Hello there," said Strike,
breaking off suddenly, his eyes on the door. Robin turned and saw, to her momentary astonishment, a slender woman wearing a long green Tudor gown and headdress.
"I'm so sorry," said the woman,
gesturing at her costume and laughing nervously as she advanced on their table.
"I thought I'd have time to change. I've been doing a school group. We finished late."
Strike stood up and held out a hand to shake hers.
"Cormoran Strike," he said, eyes on her reproduction pearl necklace with its suspended initial B. He said, "Anne Boleyn, I presume."
Cynthia's laughter contained a couple of inadvertent snorts, which increased her odd resemblance, middle-aged though she was, to a gawky schoolgirl. Her movements were unsuited to the sweeping velvet gown, being rather exaggerated and ungainly.
"Yes, that's me. Only my second time as Anne. You think you thought of all the question the kids might ask you, then one of them says, 'How did it feel to get your head cut off?'"
Cynthia wasn't at all what Robin had expected. She now realized that her imagination had sketched in a young blonde the stereotypical idea of a Scandinavian au pair. Or was that because Sarah Shadlock had almost white hair?
"Coffee?" Strike asked Cynthia.
"Oh, coffee, yes, please, wonderful, thank you," said Cynthia,
over-enthusiastically. When Strike had left, Cynthia made a small pantomime of dithering over which seat to take until Robin, smiling, pulled out the seat beside her and offered her own hand, too.
"Oh, yes, hello,"
said Cynthia, sitting down and shaking hands. She had a thin, sallow face, currently wearing an anxious smile. The irises of her large eyes were heavily mottled, an indeterminate colour between blue, green and grey, and her teeth were rather crooked.
"So you lead the touring character?" asked Robin. "Yes, exactly, as poor Anne,"
said Cynthia, with another nervous, snorting laugh.
"I couldn't give the king a son. They said I was a witch. Those are the sort of things children like to hear. I have to work quite hard to get the politics in. Poor Anne."
Her thin hands fidgeted.
"Oh, I'm still... I can take this off, at least..."
Cynthia set to work unpinning her headdress. Even though she could tell that Cynthia was very nervous and that her constant laughter was more of a tic than genuine amusement, Robin was again reminded of Sarah Shadlock who tended to laugh a lot and loudly, especially in the vicinity of Matthew. Wittingly or not, Cynthia's laughter imposed a sort of obligation, smile back or seem hostile. Robin remembered a documentary on monkeys she had watched one night when she was too tired to get up and go to bed. Chimps, too, laughed back at each other to signal social cohesion. When Strike returned to the table with Cynthia's coffee, he found her newly bareheaded. Her dark hair was 50% grey and smoothed back into a short, thin ponytail.
"It's very good of you to meet us, Mrs. Phipps," he said, sitting back down.
"Oh, no, not at all, not at all,"
said Cynthia, waving her thin hands and laughing some more.
"Anything I can do to help Anna with. But Roy hasn't been well, so I don't want to worry him just now."
"I'm sorry to hear."
"Yes, thank you, no. It's prostate cancer," said Cynthia, no longer laughing. "Radiation therapy, not feeling too chipper. Anna and Kim came over this morning to sit with him, or I wouldn't have been able. I don't like leaving him at the moment, but the girls are there, so I thought I'd be fine to—"
The end of the sentence was lost as she took a sip of coffee. Her hand trembled slightly as she replaced the cup onto the saucer.
"Your stepdaughter's probably told—"
Strike began, but Cynthia immediately interrupted him.
"Daughter! I don't ever call Anna my stepdaughter, sorry, but I feel just the same about her as I do about Jeremy and Ellie. No difference at all."
Robin wondered whether that was true. She was uncomfortably aware that part of her was standing aside, watching Cynthia with judgmental eyes. "She isn't Sarah," Robin reminded herself.
"Well, I'm sure Anna's told you why she hired us and so on."
"Oh, yes," said Cynthia. "No, I must admit I've been expecting something like this for a while. I hope it isn't going to make things worse for her."
Well, we hope that too, obviously," said Strike.
And Cynthia laughed and said, "Oh, no, of course, yes."
Strike took out his notebook, in which a few photocopied sheets were folded, and a pen.
"Could we begin with a statement you gave the police?"
"You've got it,"
said Cynthia, looking startled.
"The original?"
"A photocopy," he said, unfolding it.
"How funny! Seeing it again after all this time. I was 18. 18. It seems a century ago."
The signature at the bottom of the uppermost page, Robin saw, was rounded and rather childish. Strike handed the photocopied pages to Cynthia, who took them looking almost frightened.
"I'm afraid I'm awfully dyslexic," she said. "I was 42 before I was diagnosed. My parents thought I was bone idle." So...
"Would you rather I read it to you?" Strike suggested.
Cynthia handed it back to him at once.
"Oh, thank you. This is how I learn all my guiding notes, by listening to audio discs."
Strike flattened out the photocopied papers on the table.
"Please interrupt if you want to add or change anything," he told Cynthia,
who nodded and said that she would.
"Name Cynthia Jane Phipps. Date of birth, July the 20th, 1957. Address, the Annex, Broom House, Church Road. That would be Margot's."
"I had self-contained rooms over the double garage," said Cynthia.
Robin thought she laid slight emphasis on self-contained.
"I am employed as nanny to Dr. Phipps and Dr. Bamborough's infant daughter, and I live in their house."
"Self-contained studio," said Cynthia. "It had its own entrance."
"My hours? Don't think we need any of that," muttered Strike. "Here we go. On the morning of the 11th of October, I began work at 7 a.m. I saw Dr. Bamborough before she left for work. She seemed entirely as usual. She reminded me that she would be late home because she was meeting her friend, Miss Una Kennedy, for drinks near her place of work. As Dr. Phipps was bedbound due to his recent accident..."
"Anna told you about Roy's von Willebrand disease," said Cynthia anxiously.
I don't think she told us, but it's mentioned in the police report."
"Oh, didn't she say?"
said Cynthia, who seemed unhappy to hear it.
"Well, he's a type 3. That's serious, as bad as haemophilia. His knees swelled up and he was in a lot of pain. Could hardly move," said Cynthia.
"Yes," said Strike. "It's all in the police."
"No, because he'd had an accident on the 7th," said Cynthia, who seemed determined to say this. "It was a wet day, pouring with rain, you can check that. He was walking around a corner of the hospital, heading for the car park, and an outpatient rode right into him on a pushbike. Roy got tangled up in the front wheel, slipped, hit his knee, and had a major bleed. These days he has prophylactic injections, so it doesn't happen the way it used to, but back then, if he injured himself, it could lay him up for weeks."
"Right," said Strike, and judging it to be the most tactful thing to do, he made careful note of all these details, which he'd already read in Roy's own statements and police interviews.
"No, Anna knows her dad was ill that day. She's always known," Cynthia added.
Strike continued reading the statement aloud. It was a retelling of facts Strike and Robin already knew. Cynthia had been in charge of baby Anna at home. Roy's mother had come over during the day. Wilma Bayliss had cleaned for 3 hours and left. Cynthia had taken occasional cups of tea to the invalid and his mother. At 6 p.m, Evelyn Phipps had gone home to her bungalow to play bridge with friends, leaving a tray of food for her son.
"At 8 p.m. in the evening I was watching television in the sitting room downstairs when I heard the phone ring in the hall. I would usually only ever answer the phone if both Dr. Phipps and Dr. Bamborough were out. As Dr. Phipps was in and could answer the phone from the extension beside his bed, I didn't answer. About 5 minutes later I heard the gong that Mrs. Evelyn Phipps had placed beside Dr. Phipps's bed in case of emergency. I went upstairs. Dr. Phipps was still in bed. He told me that it had been Miss Kennedy on the phone. Dr. Bamborough hadn't turned up at the pub. Dr. Phipps said he thought she must have been delayed at work or forgotten. He asked me to tell Dr. Bamborough to go up to their bedroom as soon as she came in. I went back downstairs. About an hour later, I heard the gong again and went upstairs and found Dr. Phipps now quite worried about his wife. He asked me whether she'd come in yet. I said that she hadn't. He asked me to stay in the room while he phoned Miss Kennedy at home. Miss Kennedy still hadn't seen or heard from Dr. Bamborough. Dr. Phipps hung up and asked me what Dr. Bamborough had been carrying when she left the house that morning. I told him just a handbag and her doctor's bag. He asked me whether Dr. Bamborough had said anything about visiting her parents. I said she hadn't. He asked me to stay while he called Dr. Bamborough's mother. Mrs. Bamborough hadn't heard from her daughter or seen her. Dr. Phipps was now quite worried and asked me to go downstairs and look in the drawer in the base of the clock on the mantelpiece in the sitting room and see whether there was anything in there. I went and looked. There was nothing there. I went back upstairs and told Dr. Phipps that the clock drawer was empty. Dr. Phipps explained that this was a place he and his wife sometimes left each other private notes. I hadn't known about this previously. He asked me to stay with him while he called his mother, because he might have something else for me to do. He spoke to his mother and asked her advice. It was a brief conversation. When he hung up, Dr. Phipps asked me whether I thought he ought to call the police. I said I thought he should. He said he was going to. He told me to go downstairs and let the police in when they arrived and show them up to his bedroom. The police arrived about half an hour later, and I showed them up to Dr. Phipps's bedroom. I didn't find Dr. Bamborough to be unusual in her manner when she left the house that morning. Relations between Dr. Phipps and Dr. Bamborough seem completely happy. I'm very surprised at her disappearance, which is out of character. She is very attached to her daughter, and I cannot imagine her ever leaving the baby or going away without telling her husband or me where she was going. Signed and dated Cynthia Phipps, 12th of October, 1974.
"Yes, no, that's... I haven't got anything to add to that," said Cynthia. "Odd to hear it back," she said, with another little snorting laugh. But Robin thought her eyes were frightened.
"This is obviously, sensitive. But if we could go back to your statement that relations between Roy and Margot..."
"Yes, sorry, no, I'm not going to talk about their marriage," said Cynthia. Her sallow cheeks became stained with a purplish blush. "Everyone rows, everyone has ups and downs, but it's not up to me to talk about their marriage."
"We understand that your husband couldn't have..." began Robin.
"Margot's husband," said Cynthia. No, you see, they're two completely different people inside my head.
Convenient, said a voice inside Robin's. We're simply exploring the possibility that she went away, said Strike. Maybe to think, or...
No, Margot wouldn't have just walked out without saying anything. That wouldn't have been like her.
Anna told us her grandmother, said Robin.
Evelyn had early-onset Alzheimer's, and you couldn't take what she said seriously, said Cynthia, her tone higher and more brittle. I've always told Anna that. I've always told her that Margot would never have left her. I've always told her that, she repeated.
Except, continued the voice inside Robin's head, when you were pretending to be a real mother and hiding Margot's existence from her. Moving on, said Strike. You received a phone call on Anna's second birthday from a woman purporting to be Margot.
Yes, no, that's right, said Cynthia.
She took another shaky sip of coffee.
I was icing the birthday cake in the kitchen when the phone rang, so not in any danger of forgetting what day it was. When I picked up, the woman said, "Is that you, Cynthia?" I said, "Yes," and she said, "It's Margot here. Wish little Annie a happy birthday from her mummy, and make sure you look after her." And the line went dead. I just stood there, she mimed, holding an invisible implement in her hand, and tried to laugh again, but no sound came out. Holding the spatula, I didn't know what to do. Anna was playing in the sitting room. I decided I'd better ring Roy at work. He told me to call the police, so I did.
Did you think it was Margot? Asked Strike.
No, it wasn't. Well, it sounded like her, but I don't think it was her.
You think somebody was imitating it?
Putting it on, yes. The accent, Cockney, but no, I didn't get that feeling you get when you just know who it is.
You're sure it was a woman? Said Strike. It couldn't have been a man imitating a woman.
I don't think so, said Cynthia. Did Margot ever call Anna Little Annie? Asked Robin. She called her all kinds of pet names, said Cynthia, looking glum. Annie Fandango, Annabella, Angel Face. Somebody could have guessed, or maybe they'd just got the name wrong. But the timing was, they just found bits of Creed's last victim, the one he threw off Beachy Head.
Andrea Houghton, said Robin. Cynthia looked slightly startled that she had the name on the tip of her tongue.
Yes, the hairdresser.
No, said Robin. That was Susan Mayer. Andrea was the PhD student.
Oh, yes, said Cynthia. Of course, I'm so bad with names. Well, Roy had just been through the whole identification business with them, you know, the bits of the body that washed up, so we'd had our hopes. Not our hopes, said Cynthia, looking terrified at the word that had escaped her. I don't mean that, no. We were obviously relieved it wasn't Margot, but you think, you know, maybe you're going to get an answer.
Strike thought of his own guilty wish that Joan's slow and protracted dying would be over soon. A corpse, however unwelcome, meant anguish could find both expression and sublimation among flowers, speeches and ritual, consolation drawn from God, alcohol and fellow mourners. An apotheosis reached, a first step taken towards grasping the awful fact that life was extinct, and life must go on.
We'd already been through it once when they found the other body, the one in Alexandra Lake, said Cynthia.
Susan Mayer, muttered Robin.
Roy was shown pictures, both times, and then this phone call coming right after he'd had to. For the second time, it was...
Cynthia was suddenly crying. Not like Una Kennedy, with her head up and tears sparkling on her cheeks, but hunched over the table, hiding her face, her shaking hands supporting her forehead.
I'm so sorry, she sobbed. I knew this would be awful. We never talk about her anymore. I'm sorry.
She sobbed for a few more seconds, then forced herself to look up again, her large eyes now pink and wet.
Roy wanted to believe it had been Margot on the phone. He kept saying... Are you sure? Are you sure it didn't sound like her? He was on tenterhooks while the police traced the call. You're being very polite, she said,
and her laugh this time was slightly hysterical.
But I know what you want to know, and what Anna wants to know too, even though I've told her and told her. There was nothing going on between me and Roy before Margot disappeared, and not for 4 years afterwards. Did she tell you that Roy and I
are related?"
She said it as though forcing herself to say it, although a third cousin was not, after all, a very close relationship. But Robin, thinking of Roy's bleeding disorder, wondered whether the Phippses, like the Romanovs, mightn't be well advised not to marry their cousins.
"Yes, she did," said Strike.
"I was sick of the sound of his name before I went to work for them, actually. It was all, 'Just look at Cousin Roy with all his health problems getting into Imperial College and studying medicine. If only you'd work harder, Cynthia. I used to hate the very idea of him.'"
Robin recalled the picture of young Roy in the press, the sensitive face, the floppy hair, the poet's eyes. Many women found injury and illness romantic in a handsome man. Hadn't Matthew, in his worst effusions of jealousy against Strike, invoked his amputated leg, the warrior's wound against which he, whole-bodied and fit, felt unable to compete?
"You might not believe this, but as far as I was concerned at 17, the best thing about Roy was Margot. No, I thought she was marvellous, so fashionable and, you know, lots of opinions and things. She asked me over for dinner, after she heard I ploughed all my exams. Well, I hero-worshipped her, so I was thrilled. I poured my heart out, told her I couldn't face resits. I just wanted to get out in the real world and earn my own money. And she said, 'Look, you're wonderful with children. How about coming and looking after my baby when I go back to work? I'll get Roy to do up the rooms over the garage for you.' My parents were livid,"
said Cynthia, with another brave but unsuccessful stab at a laugh.
"They were furious with her and Roy, although actually he didn't want me there in the first place, because he wanted Margot to stay at home and look after Anna herself. Mummy and Daddy said she was just after cheap labour. These days I do see it more from their point of view. I'm not sure I'd have been delighted if a woman had persuaded one of my girls to leave school and move in with them and look after their baby. But no, I loved Margot. I was excited."
Cynthia fell silent for a moment, a faraway look in her doleful eyes, and Robin wondered whether she was thinking about the huge and unalterable consequences of accepting the job as nanny, which, instead of being a springboard to her own independent life, had placed her in a house she would never leave, led to her raising Margot's child as her own, sleeping with Margot's husband, forever stuck in the shadow of the doctor she claimed to have loved. What was it like to live with an absence that huge?
"My parents wanted me to go away after Margot disappeared. They didn't like me being alone at the house with Roy because people were starting to gossip. There were even hints in the press. But I swear to you, on the lives of my children," said Cynthia with a kind of dull finality, "there was nothing between Roy and me ever before Margot disappeared, and not for a long time afterwards either. I stayed for Anna, because I couldn't bear to leave her. She'd become my daughter."
"She hadn't," said the implacable voice in Robin's head, "and you should have told her so."
"Roy didn't date anyone for a long time after Margot disappeared. Then there was a colleague at work for a while."
Cynthia's thin face flushed again.
"But it only lasted a few months. Anna didn't like her. I had a kind of on-off boyfriend, but he packed me in. He said it was like dating a married woman with a child, because I put Anna and Roy first, always. And then, I suppose," said Cynthia shakily, one hand balled in a fist, the other clutching it, "over time, I realized I'd fallen in love with Roy. I never dreamed he'd want to be with me, though. Margot was so clever and such a big personality, and he was so much older than me, so much more intelligent and sophisticated. One evening, after I'd put Anna to bed, I was about to go back to my rooms, and he asked me what had happened with Will, my boyfriend. And I said it was over, and he asked what had happened, and we got talking, and he said, "You're a very special person, and you deserve far better than him." And then we had a drink. That was 4 years after she disappeared," Cynthia repeated. "I was 18 when she vanished, and I was 22 when Roy and I admitted we had feelings for each other. We kept it secret, obviously. It was another 3 years before Roy could get a death certificate for Margot."
"That must have been very hard," said Strike.
Cynthia looked at him for a moment, unsmiling. She seemed to have aged since arriving at the table.
"I've had nightmares about Margot coming back and throwing me out of the house for nearly 40 years, she said,
and she tried to laugh.
"I've never told Roy. I don't want to know whether he dreams about her too. We don't talk about her. It's the only way to cope. We'd said everything we had to say to the police, to each other, to the rest of the family. We'd raked it all over, hours and hours of talking. It's time to close the door." That's how Roy put it. He said, "We've left the door open long enough. She's not coming back." There were a couple of spiteful things said in the press, you know, when we got married. Husband of vanished doctor marries young nanny. It's always going to sound sordid, isn't it? Roy said not to mind them. My parents were appalled by the whole thing. It was only when I had Jeremy that they came around. We never meant to mislead Anna. We were waiting, I don't know, trying to find the right moment to explain, but how are you supposed to do it? She used to call me Mummy, whispered Cynthia. She was happy. She was a completely happy little girl. But then those children at school told her about Margot, and it ruined every—
From somewhere close by came a loud synthesizer version of Greensleeves. All three of them looked startled until Cynthia, laughing her snorting laugh, said,
"It's my phone."
She pulled the mobile from a deep pocket in her dress and answered it.
"Roy?"
she said. Robin could hear Roy talking angrily from where she sat. Cynthia looked suddenly alarmed. She tried to get up, but stepped on the hem of her dress and tripped forwards. Trying to disentangle herself, she said,
"No, I'm—" "Oh, she hasn't. Oh, God, Roy, I didn't want to tell you because—" "No, yes, I'm still with them."
Finally managing to free herself from both dress and table, Cynthia staggered away and out of the room. The headdress she'd been wearing slid limply off her seat. Robin stooped to pick it up, put it back on the seat of Cynthia's chair, and looked up to see Strike watching her.
"What?"
asked Robin. He was about to answer when Cynthia reappeared. She looked stricken.
"Roy knows. Anna's told him. He wants you to come back to Broom House."
Chapter 36. He oft finds medicine who his grief imparts, but double griefs afflict concealing hearts, as raging flames who striveth to suppress. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Cynthia hurried away to change out of her Anne Boleyn costume, and reappeared 10 minutes later in a pair of poorly fitting jeans, a grey sweater, and trainers. She appeared extremely anxious as they walked together back through the palace, setting a fast pace that Strike found challenging on cobblestones still slippery with the rain, which had temporarily ceased. But the heavy grey clouds, gilt-edged though they were, promised an imminent return. Glancing upwards as they passed back through the gatehouse of the inner court, Robin's eye was caught by the gleaming gold accents on the astronomical clock, and noticed that the sun was in Margot's sign of Aquarius.
"I'll see you there,"
said Cynthia breathlessly, as they approached the car park, and without waiting for an answer, she half ran towards a blue Mazda 3 in the distance.
"This is going to be interesting," said Robin.
"Certainly is," said Strike.
"Grab the map," said Robin, once both were back in the car. The old Land Rover didn't have a functioning radio, let alone sat-nav. "You'll have to navigate."
"What do you think of her?" asked Strike, while he looked up Church Road in Ham. "She seems all right."
Robin became aware that Strike was looking at her, as he had in the cafe, a slightly quizzical expression on his face.
"What?"
she said again.
"I had the impression you weren't keen."
"No,"
said Robin, with a trace of defensiveness. "She's fine." She reversed out of the parking space, remembering Cynthia's snorting laughter and her habit of jumbling affirmatives and negatives together.
"Well?"
"Thought so," said Strike smugly.
"Given what might have happened to Margot, I wouldn't have kicked off the conversation with cheery decapitation jokes."
"She's lived with it for 40 years, said Strike. "People who live with something that massive stop being able to see it.
It's the backdrop of their lives. It's only glaringly obvious to everyone else. It started to rain again as they left the car park, a fine veil laying itself swiftly over the windscreen.
Okay, I'm prejudiced, Robin admitted, switching on the wipers. Feeling a bit sensitive about second wives right now.
She drove on for a few moments before coming aware that Strike was looking at her again.
What?
She asked for a third time.
Why are you sensitive about second wives?
Because... Oh, I didn't tell you, did I? I told Morris.
She tried not to think since about her drunken boxing days spent texting, of the small amount of comfort she had derived from it, or the immense load of discomfort. Matthew and Sarah Shadlock are together officially now. She left her fiancé for him.
Shit, said Strike, still watching her profile. No, you didn't tell me.
But he mentally docketed the fact that she'd told Morris, which didn't fit with the idea that he'd formed of Robin and Morris's relationship. From what Barclay had told him about Morris's challenges to Robin's authority, and from Robin's generally lukewarm comments on his new hire, he'd assume that Morris's undoubted sexual interest in Robin had fizzled out for lack of a return. And yet she told Morris this painful bit of personal information, and not told him. As they drove in silence towards Church Road, he wondered what had been going on in London while he had been in Cornwall. Morris was a good-looking man, and he, like Robin, was divorcing. Strike wondered why he hadn't previously considered the implications of this obvious piece of symmetry. Comparing notes on lawyers, on difficult exes, on the mechanics of splitting two lives, they'd have plenty to talk about, plenty of opportunities for mutual sympathy.
Straight up here, he said,
and they drove in silence across the royal paddocks between high, straight red walls.
Nice street, commented Robin, 20 minutes after they'd left Hampton Court Palace, as she turned the Land Rover into a road that might have been deep in countryside.
To their left was dense woodland, to the right several large detached houses that stood back from the road behind high hedges.
It's that one, said Strike,
pointing at a particularly sprawling house with many pointed, half-timbered gables. The double gate stood open, as did the front door. They turned into the drive, and parked behind the blue Mazda 3. As soon as Robin switched off the engine, they heard shouting coming from inside the house. A male voice, intemperate and high-pitched. Anna Phipps's wife, Kim, tall, blonde and wearing jeans and a shirt as before, came striding out of the house towards them, her expression tense.
Big scenes, she said, as Strike and Robin got out of the car into the mist of rain.
Would you like us to wait?
Robin began.
No, Kim said. He's determined to see you. Come in.
They walked across the gravel and entered Broom House. Somewhere inside, male and female voices continued to shout. Every house has its own deep, ingrained smell, and this one was redolent of sandalwood and a not entirely unpleasant fustiness. Kim led them through a long, large-windowed hall that seemed frozen in the mid-20th century. There were brass light fittings, watercolours, and an old rug on polished floorboards. With a sudden frisson, Robin thought that Margot Bamborough had once walked this very floor, a metallic rose perfume mingling with a sense of polish and old carpet. As they approached the door of the drawing room, the argument taking place inside became suddenly comprehensible.
"And if I'm to be talked about,"
a man was shouting,
"I should have right of reply. My family deciding to investigate me behind my back. Charming, charming. It really is.
Nobody's investigating you, for God's sake,"
they heard Anna say.
"Bill Talbot was incompetent."
"Oh, was he really? Were you there? Did you know him?"
"I didn't have to be there, Dad."
Kim opened the door. Strike and Robin followed Kim inside. It was like coming upon a tableau. The three people standing inside froze at their entrance. Cynthia's thin fingers were pressed to her mouth. Anna stood facing her father across a small antique table. The romantic-looking poet of 1974 was no more. Roy Phipps's remaining hair was short, grey, and clung only around his ears and the back of his head. In his knitted sweater vest,
with his high-domed shining pate and his wild eyes, slightly sunken in a blotchy face, he'd now be better suited to the role of mad scientist. So furious did Roy Phipps look that Robin quite expected him to start shouting at the newcomers too. However, the hematologist's demeanour changed when his eyes met Strike's. Whether this was a tribute to the detective's bulk, or to the aura of gravity and calm he managed to project in highly charged situations, Robin couldn't tell. But she thought she saw Roy decide against yelling. After a brief hesitation, the doctor accepted Strike's proffered hand, and as the two men shook, Robin wondered how aware men were of the power dynamics that played out between them, while women stood watching.
"Dr. Phipps," said Strike.
Roy appeared to have found the gear change between intemperate rage and polite greeting a difficult one, and his immediate response was slightly incoherent.
"So, you're the detective, are you?" he said.
Bluish-red blotches lingered in his pale cheeks.
"Cormoran Strike, and this is my partner, Robin Ellicott."
Robin stepped forward.
"How do you do?" Roy said stiffly, shaking her hand too. His was hot and dry.
"Shall I make coffee?"
said Cynthia, in a half-whisper.
"Yes, no, why not?" said Roy,
his ill temper clearly jockeying with the nervousness that seemed to increase while Strike stood, large and unmoving, watching him.
"Sit, sit,"
he said, pointing Strike to a sofa, at right angles to another. Cynthia hurried out of the room to make coffee, and Strike and Robin sat where they'd been instructed. "Going to help Sin," muttered Anna, and she hurried out of the room, and Kim, after a moment's hesitation, followed her, leaving Strike and Robin alone with Roy. The doctor settled himself into a high-backed velvet armchair and glared around him. He didn't look well. The flush of temper receded, leaving him looking wan. His socks had bunched up around his skinny ankles. There ensued one of the most uncomfortable silences Robin had ever endured. Mainly to avoid looking at Roy, she allowed her eyes to roam around the large room, which was as old-fashioned as the hall. A grand piano stood in the corner. More large windows looked out onto an enormous garden, where a long rectangular fish pond lay just beyond a paved area, at the far end of which lay a covered, temple-like stone structure, where people could either sit and watch the koi carp, now barely visible beneath the rain-flecked surface of the water, or look out over the sweeping lawn, with its mature trees and well-tended flower beds. An abundance of leather-bound books and bronzes of antique subjects filled bookcases and cabinets. A tambour frame stood between the sofas, on which a very beautiful piece of embroidery was being worked in silks. The design was Japanese-influenced, of two koi swimming in opposite directions. Robin was debating whether to pass polite comment on it and to ask whether Cynthia was responsible, when Strike spoke.
"Who was the classicist?"
"What?"
said Roy.
"Oh, my father."
His crazy-looking eyes roamed over the various small bronzes and marbles dotted around the room.
"Took a first in classics at Cambridge."
"Ah," said Strike,
and the glacial silence resumed. A squall of wind threw more rain at the window. Robin was relieved to hear the tinkling of teaspoons and the footsteps of the three returning women. Cynthia, who re-entered the room first, set a tea tray down on the antique table, standing between the sofas. It rocked a little with the weight. Anna added a large cake on a stand. Anna and Kim sat down side by side on the free sofa, and when Cynthia had drawn up spindly side tables to hold everyone's tea and cut slices of cake for those who wanted some, she sat herself down beside her stepdaughter-in-law, looking scared.
"Well," said Roy at last, addressing Strike, "I'd be interested to hear what you think your chances are of finding out what the Metropolitan Police has been unable to discover in 4 decades.
Robin was sure Roy had been planning this aggressive opening during a long and painful silence.
"Fairly small," said Strike, matter-of-factly,
once he'd swallowed a large piece of the cake Cynthia had given him.
"Though we've got a new alleged sighting of your first wife I wanted to discuss with you."
Roy looked taken aback.
Alleged sighting, Strike emphasized,
setting down his plate and reaching inside his jacket for his notebook.
But obviously, excellent cake, Mrs. Phipps, he told Cynthia.
Oh, thank you, she said in a small voice. Coffee and walnut was Anna's favourite when she was little, wasn't it, love? She said.
But Anna's only response was a tense smile.
We heard about it from one of your wife's ex-colleagues, Janice Beattie.
Roy shook his head and shrugged impatiently, to convey non-recognition of the names.
She was the practice nurse at the St. John's surgery, said Strike.
Oh,
said Roy. Yes, I think she came here once for a barbecue. She seemed quite a decent woman. Disaster that afternoon. Bloody disaster. Those children were atrocious, do you remember? He shot at Cynthia.
Yes,
said Cynthia quickly.
No, there was one boy who was really...
Spiked the punch, barked Roy. Vodka. Someone was sick.
Gloria,
said Cynthia.
I don't remember all their names, said Roy, with an impatient wave of the hand. Sick all over the downstairs bathroom. Disgusting.
This boy would have been Carl Oakton, asked Strike.
That's him, said Roy.
We found the vodka bottle empty later, hidden in a shed. He'd sneaked into the house and taken it out of the drinks cabinet.
Yes,
said Cynthia.
And then he smashed crystal bowl of my mother's and half a dozen glasses. Hit a cricket ball right across the barbecue area. The nurse cleaned it all up for me because... Decent of her.
She knew I couldn't. Broken glass, said Roy with an impatient gesture.
On the bright side, said Cynthia, with a ghost of a laugh, he'd smashed the punch, so nobody else got sick.
That bowl was Art Deco, said Roy, unsmiling. Bloody disaster, the whole thing.
I said to Margot,
and he paused for a second after saying the name, and Robin wondered when he'd last spoken it.
I don't know what you think this is going to achieve, because he didn't come, the one she was trying to conciliate, the doctor she didn't get on with.
What was his...
Joseph Brenner, said Robin.
Brenner, exactly. He'd refused the invitation. So what was the point? But no, we still had to give up our Saturday to entertain this motley collection of people, and our reward was to have our drink stolen and our possessions smashed.
Roy's fists lay on the arms of his chair. He uncoiled the long fingers for a moment, in a movement like a hermit crab unflexing its legs, then curled them tightly in upon themselves again.
That same boy, Oakton, wrote a book about Margot later, he said. Used a photograph from that damn barbecue to add credibility to the notion that he and his mother knew all about our private lives. So, yes, said Roy coldly, not one of Margot's better ideas.
Well, she was trying to make the practice work better together, wasn't she? Said Anna. You've never really needed to manage different personalities at work.
Oh! You know all about my work too, do you, Anna?
Well, it wasn't the same as being a GP, was it? Said Anna. You were lecturing, doing research. You didn't have to manage cleaners and receptionists and a whole bunch of non-medics. They were quite badly behaved, Anna, said Cynthia, hurrying loyally to support Roy. No, they really were. I never told. I didn't want to cause trouble, but one of the women sneaked upstairs into your mum and dad's bedroom.
What?
Barked Roy.
Yes,
said Cynthia nervously.
No, I went upstairs to change Anna's nappy, and I heard movement in there. I walked in, and she was looking at Margot's clothes in the wardrobe.
Who was this? Asked Strike.
The blonde one, the receptionist who wasn't Gloria.
Irene, said Strike. Did she know you'd seen her?
Oh, yes, I walked in holding Anna.
What did she say when she saw you? Asked Robin.
Well, she was a bit embarrassed, said Cynthia. You would be, wouldn't you? She laughed and said, just being nosy, and walked back out past me.
Good God, said Roy Phipps, shaking his head. Who hired these people?
Was she really just looking? Robin asked Cynthia. Or do you think she'd gone in there too?
Oh, I don't think she'd taken anything, said Cynthia. And you never... Margot never missed anything, did she?
She asked Roy.
No, but you should still have told me this at the time, said Roy crossly.
I didn't want to cause trouble. You were already... Well, it was a stressful day, wasn't it?
About this alleged sighting, said Strike.
and he told the family the third-hand tale of Charlie Ramage, who claimed to have seen Margot wandering among graves in a churchyard in Leamington Spa.
And Robbins now spoken to Ramage's widow, who confirmed the basic story, though she couldn't swear to it that it was Margot he'd thought he'd seen, and not another missing woman. The sighting doesn't seem to have been passed on to the police, so I wanted to ask whether Margot had any connection with Leamington Spa that you know of.
None, said Roy, and Cynthia shook her head.
Strike made a note.
Thank you.
While we're on the subject of sightings, said Strike, I wonder whether we could run through the rest of the list.
Robin thought she knew what Strike was up to. However uncomfortable the idea that Margot was still alive might be for the people in this room, Strike wanted to start the interview from a standpoint that didn't presume murder.
The woman at the service station in Birmingham, the mother in Brighton, the dog walker down in Eastbourne, Roy rattled off, before Strike could speak. Why would she have been out and about driving cars and walking dogs? If she'd disappeared voluntarily, she clearly didn't want to be found. The same goes for wandering around graveyards.
True, said Strike.
But there was one sighting.
Warwick, said Roy.
Yes.
A look passed between husband and wife. Strike waited.
Roy set down his cup and saucer on the table in front of him and looked up at his daughter.
"You're quite sure you want to do this, Anna, are you?"
he asked, looking at his silent daughter.
"Quite, quite sure."
"What do you mean?" she snapped back. "What do you think I hire detectives for? Fun?"
"All right, then," said Roy. "All right. That sighting caught my attention because my wife's ex-boyfriend, a man called Paul Satchwell, hailed originally from Warwick. This was a man she'd reconnected with before she disappeared."
"Oh, for God's sake," said Anna, with a tight little laugh. "Did you honestly think I don't know about Paul Satchwell? Of course I do."
Kim reached out and put a hand on her wife's leg. Whether in comfort or warning, it was hard to tell.
"Have you never heard of the Internet, Dad, or press archives? I've seen Satchwell's ridiculous photograph, with all his chest hair and his medallions, and I know my mother went for a drink with him 3 weeks before she vanished. But it was only one drink."
"Oh, was it?" said Roy nastily. "Thanks for your reassurance, Anna. Thanks for your expert knowledge. How marvellous to be all-knowing."
"Roy," whispered Cynthia. "What are you saying? That it was more than a drink?" said Anna, looking shaken. "No, it wasn't. That's a horrible thing to say.
Una says..." "Oh, right, yes, I see," said Roy loudly, his sunken cheeks turning purple as his hands gripped the arms of his chair. "Una says, does she? Everything is explained."
"What's explained?" demanded Anna.
"This," he shouted, pointing a trembling, rope-veined, swollen-knuckled hand at Strike and Robin. "Una Kennedy's behind all, is she? I should have known I hadn't heard the last of her."
"For God's sake, Roy," said Kim loudly. "That's preposterous.
Una Kennedy wanted me arrested."
"Dad, that's simply not true," said Anna, forcibly removing Kim's restraining hand from her leg. "You've got a morbid fixation about Una,
badgering me to complain about Talbot."
"Well, why the bloody hell didn't you?" said Anna loudly. "The man was in the middle of a fully-fledged breakdown."
"Roy," whimpered Cynthia again, as Roy leaned forward to face his daughter across the too small circular table with its precariously balanced cake. Gesticulating wildly, his face purple, he shouted,
"Police swarming all over the house, going through your mother's things, sniffer dogs out in the garden. They were looking for any reason to arrest me, and I should lodge a formal complaint against the man in charge. How would that have looked? He was incompetent. Were you there, Miss Omniscient? Did you know him?"
"Why did they replace him? Why does everything written about the case say he was incompetent? The truth is," said Anna, stabbing the air between her and her father with a forefinger, "you and Sin loved Bill Talbot because he thought you were innocent from the off, and—"
"Thought I was innocent?"
bellowed Roy.
"Well, thank you. It's good to know that nothing's changed since you were 13 years old.
Roy," said Cynthia and Kim together,
"and accuse me of building the koi pond over the place I'd buried her."
Anna burst into tears and fled the room,
almost tripping over Strike's legs as she went. Suspecting there was about to be a mass exodus, he retracted his feet. "When," Kim said coldly to her father-in-law, "is Anna going to be forgiven for things she said when she was a confused child, going through a dreadful time?"
"And my dreadful time is nothing, of course. Nothing!" shouted Roy.
And as Strike expected, he too left the room at the fastest pace he could manage, which was a speedy hobble. "Christ's sake," muttered Kim, striding after Roy and Anna, and almost colliding at the door with Cynthia, who jumped up to follow Roy. The door swung shut. The rain pattered on the pond outside. Strike blew out his cheeks, exchanged looks with Robin, then picked up his plate and continued eating his cake.
"Starving,"
he said thickly, in response to Robin's look.
"No lunch, and it's good cake."
Distantly they heard shouting and the slamming of another door. "Do you think the interview's over?" muttered Robin.
"Nope," said Strike, still eating. "They'll be back."
"Remind me about the sighting in Warwick," said Robin. She'd merely skimmed the list of sightings that Strike had emailed her. There hadn't seemed anything very interesting there.
"A woman asked for a change in a pub, and the landlady thought she was Margot. A mature student came forward 2 days later to identify herself, but the landlady wasn't convinced that was who she'd seen. The police were, though."
Strike took another large mouthful of cake before saying,
"I don't think there's anything in it."
"Well."
He swallowed and shot a meaningful look at the sitting room door.
"There's a bit more now."
Strike continued to eat cake, while Robin's eyes roamed the room and landed on an ormolu mantel clock of exceptional ugliness. With a glance at the door, she got up to examine it. A gilded classical goddess, wearing a helmet, sat on top of the ornate heavy case.
"Pallas Athena," said Strike,
watching her, pointing his fork at the figure. In the base of the clock was a drawer with a small brass handle. Remembering Cynthia's statement about Roy and Margot leaving notes for each other here, she pulled the drawer open. It was lined in red felt and empty. "Do you think it's valuable?" she asked Strike, sliding the door shut.
"Dunno. Why?"
"Because why else would you keep it? It's horrible." There were two distinct kinds of taste on view in this room, and they didn't harmonize, Robin thought, as she looked around, all the time listening out for the return of the family. The leather-bound copies of Ovid and Pliny, and the Victorian reproductions of classical statues, among them a pair of miniature Medici lions, a reproduction Vestal Virgin, and a Hermes poised on tiptoe on his heavy bronze base, presumably represented Roy's father's taste, whereas she suspected that his mother had chosen the insipid watercolour landscapes and botanical subjects, the dainty antique furniture, and the chintz curtains. Why had Roy never made a clean sweep and redecorated, Robin wondered? Reverence for his parents? Lack of imagination? Or had the sickly little boy, housebound no doubt for much of his childhood, developed an attachment to these objects that he couldn't put aside? He and Cynthia seemed to have made little impression on the room, other than in adding a few family pictures to faded black-and-white photos featuring Roy's parents and Roy as a child. The only one to hold Robin's interest was a family group that looked as though it had been taken in the early 90s, when Roy had still had all his hair and Cynthia's had been thick and wavy. Their two biological children, a boy and a girl, looked like Anna. Nobody would have guessed that she'd had a different mother. Robin moved to the window. The surface of the long, formal koi pond outside, with its stone pavilion at the end, was now so densely rain-pocked that the vivid red, white, and black shapes moving beneath the surface were barely discernible as fish. There was one particularly big creature, pearl-white and black, that looked as though it might be over 2 feet long. The miniature pavilion would normally be reflected in the pond's smooth surface, but today it merely added an extra layer of diffuse grey to the far end of the pond. It had a strangely familiar design on the floor.
"Cormoran," Robin said,
at the exact moment Strike said, "Look at this." Both turned. Strike, who'd finished his cake, was now standing beside one of Roy's father's statuettes, which Robin had overlooked. It was a foot-high bronze of a naked man with a cloth around his shoulders, holding a snake. Momentarily puzzled, Robin realized after a second or two why Strike was pointing at it.
Oh, the snake he invented sign Talbot gave Roy.
Precisely. "This is Asclepius," said Strike, "Greek god of medicine. What have you found?"
"Look on the floor of the gazebo thing, inlaid in the stone." He joined her at the window.
"Ah," he said, "you can see the beginnings of that in one of the photographs of Margot's barbecue. It was under construction."
A cross of St. John lay on the floor of the gazebo, inlaid in darker granite.
"Interesting choice of design," said Strike.
"You know," said Robin, turning to look at the room, "people who are manic often think they're receiving supernatural messages, things the sane would call coincidences."
"I was thinking exactly that," said Strike, turning to look at the figure of Pallas Athena on top of the ugly mantel clock. "To a man in Talbot's state of mental confusion, I'm guessing this room would have seemed crammed with astrological—"
Roy's voice sounded in the hall outside.
"Then don't blame me."
The door opened and the family filed back inside.
"If she hears things she doesn't like,"
Roy finished, addressing Cynthia, who was immediately behind him and looked scared. Roy's face was an unhealthy purple again, though the skin around his eyes remained a jaundiced yellow. He seemed startled to see Strike and Robin standing at the window.
"Admiring your garden," said Strike,
as he and Robin returned to their sofa. Roy grunted and took his seat again. He was breathing heavily.
"Apologies," he said, after a moment or two. "You aren't seeing the family at its best." "Very stressful for everyone," said Strike,
as Anna and Kim re-entered the room and resumed their seats on the sofa, where they sat holding hands. Cynthia perched herself beside them, watching Roy anxiously.
"I want to say something," Roy told Strike. "I want to make it perfectly clear."
"Oh, for God's sake. I've had one phone call with her," said Anna.
"I'd appreciate it, Anna," said Roy, his chest laboring, "if I could finish."
Addressing Strike, he said,
"Una Kennedy disliked me from the moment Margot and I first met. She was possessive towards Margot, and she also happened to have left the church, and she was one of those who had to make an enemy of everyone still in it. Moreover—"
"Dr. Phipps," interrupted Strike, who could foresee the afternoon degenerating into a long row about Una Kennedy,
"I think you should know that when we interviewed Una, she made it quite clear that the person she thought we should be concentrating our energies on is Paul Satchwell."
For a second or two, Roy appeared unable to fully grasp what had just been said to him.
"See," said Anna furiously, "you just implied that there was more between my mother and Satchwell than one drink. What did you mean? Or were you—"
she said, and Robin heard the underlying hope—
"just angry and lashing out?"
"People who insist on opening cans of worms, Anna," said Roy, "shouldn't complain when they get covered in slime."
"Well, go on then," said Anna. "Spill your slime."
"Anna,"
whispered Cynthia, and was ignored.
"All right," said Roy. "All right then."
He turned back to Strike and Robin.
"Early in our relationship, I saw a note of Satchwell's Margot had kept. Dear Brunhilde, it said. It was his pet name for her. The Valkyrie, you know. Margot was tall, fair."
Roy paused and swallowed.
"Some 3 weeks before she disappeared, she came home and told me she'd run into Satchwell in the street, and that they'd gone for an innocent drink."
He cleared his throat. Cynthia poured him more tea.
After she disappeared, I had to go and